The disciples were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and the other at your left, in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." The word of the Lord.
And thanks be to God. And I'll simply add to that, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So this is kind of an interesting, muddled scene. There's this group of people that are following Jesus and the 12 disciples. There's another foretelling of Jesus's plan to deliver them of his death. This is the third one in the book of Mark. And it's juxtaposed with another one of their plans or statements to desire to ascend the ranks the way that the nations around them would. And I've done a sermon series through the book of Matthew before, which, by the way, is way longer than you realize until you do a sermon series through it. But this is the first time I have done a sermon series through Mark, and it stood out to me that I thought, didn't we just preach this? Like, this is happening over and over and over in the book of Mark. It's just this repeat theme, and it comes through strong, that the disciples are on one mission to make a name for themselves, to be great, and Jesus is on another mission to suffer and to die, and the two are just standing next to each other over and over again in the book of Mark, and we are confronted with the fact that the disciples do not get it. And I believe that what we need to realize is that we are like them, and we also do not get it, and Jesus does. So we are meant to meditate on this over and over and over. So we're going to look a little deeper at this scene and the conflict, the comparison, and the Christian way. I resisted all C's. You're welcome. That was it was very tempting. But we're going to look at those four things. So here's the scene. Brian just read it to us. But the disciples are on the road going up to Jerusalem. And Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. Those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." Okay. So this is where some scholars believe that the book of Mark is changing. So it's going from being a biography, an ancient biography, which you've probably heard me explain now so many times. But the ancient biographical form gives you little punchy stories that are supposed to help you ask a question. And the question is, how do I emulate the people in the story? How do I emulate the hero of this story? And here it's moving into more of a theatrical account. And this would be a little more of what you would expect, of course, in the ancient theater, where there would be scenes and they would be working out. So actually at this point here until the end of the book of Mark, it's all about the journey to the cross for the whole rest of the way. So that means we will do this for the whole rest of the year. Interestingly, even in the Christmas season, we're going to be in this, which I actually believe is really, really helpful to do. The scene here comes together, and you need to think about this a little bit, as in Mark is painting this picture, telling this story that's going to be here to the end of the book. There's a group of people who are part of the movement. The movement is moving toward the holy city, Jerusalem. Jerusalem, as a concept, it means the city of peace, but we are preparing for a scene of violence. And you know that the readers of the book of Mark knew the story already. They know that Jesus dies in Jerusalem. They're aware of this. And what they're meditating on is how they should walk and follow Jesus in light of this story. So they're moving toward the city of peace, which is going to become the city of violence. And at the head of the crowd is Jesus, and he is walking ahead of everyone, and he's setting the pace. And it says the disciples were amazed or astonished. And it seems that their amazement or astonishment is that he, it seems, we have to look back in Mark to remember, they are aware that the scribes and Pharisees are conspiring against them with the Herodians. So the political leaders and the religious leaders are conspiring against Jesus. They know this. And where are those people? In the big city. And they're moving toward the big city, and Jesus is out front driving them to the big city. And they're amazed and astonished at his determination to get to the place where the danger is. And perhaps they're amazed but impressed. So if you're in their shoes, and he is your leader, and you're thinking more political at this time, you're like, he is bold. Wow. The conspirators are in the city, and he is bold. He's moving toward this. But then it says the crowds were afraid. And that gives you the sense that the crowds that are following after Jesus are also aware of the risk involved in moving toward Jerusalem. And they're like, what is going to happen here? And I would assume they've got their doubts engaged, their concerns, their contingency plans. If this gets dicey, I'm out the back gate, I'm getting home. They're worried. And then, which is typical, Jesus takes the 12 close disciples aside, and he gives them more of an inner conversation, the inside scoop with more detail. And he tells them more than the crowds know. He tells them, indeed, we are headed to Jerusalem. In a sense, the conspirators will succeed, the priests and the scribes and the Gentiles or the foreign rulers. They will succeed. The Jews, who at this time and in this season are unable to execute someone due to their religious convictions. So he's going to be handed over to the Romans, to the Gentiles. And this is all he's working it out for them. He says, look, the people who are conspiring against me, they will condemn me. Then they will hand me over to those who are able to kill me. They will take me and mock me and spit on me and flog me. And these are all expected outcomes from Isaiah 50 and 53 of what would come to the one that was promised to them. So this is connecting back to some Old Testament stuff, which might be encouraging. And then they will kill me. And then I will rise, which we've discussed. They may or may not totally understand what that means. So this is a massive reversal of expectations. Even though it's a repeat message, this is the most emphatic repeat message where he's getting the most detailed. And he is essentially saying, you are following me. I am your leader into a kingdom, and my kingdom will come by my weakness and destruction. And this is really hard to comprehend. Can you imagine if one of the presidential candidates were to get up on stage and describe a movement of theirs that was going to go very poorly, where they would be rejected by all of their political adversaries and actually arrested and executed? You'd go, oh, okay, that's different. Do I vote for you? You know, that's complicated. So if you were to name this theatrical exhibit of Mark's, it could be the journey to the cross, and there's going to be a moment of weakness, and this is a great reversal of expectation. And you would need to ask questions of yourself as a disciple like this. What does it mean to follow Jesus toward the cross? We should be asking that today. That's what the book of Mark is intended to help us ask. What does it mean to follow Jesus toward the cross? What will it mean for me to follow Jesus into what the world will experience or perceive as weakness and defeat? What does that mean? Okay? We need to sit there for a moment. So then the next scene is different, right? So James and John, it says, the sons of Zebedee, these are the two early disciples, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Do you sense a discontinuity in the scenes? I'm going to be executed. I'm going to die. Ah, teacher, we would like you to do whatever we ask you to do. And then Jesus' response is also surprising. He goes, "What would you like me to do for you?" And they say to us, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left hand in your glory." We tend to think spiritual glory. They're not there. They're thinking the glory in the city of Jerusalem, okay? And Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking." I like to think there's a nice long pause there. "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they pipe in, "We are? Yep." Oh. And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink. The baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it's been prepared." And when the other 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Okay. When we read this, I heard a little laughter, and we might kind of roll our eyes, right, at this moment, because we know the whole story. We know too much. And we're if you're here, you're either a Christian or open to it, and you're thinking, yeah, you know, these silly guys, you know, they don't get it. Jesus is going to die on a cross, and he's going to save us from our sins. They don't get it. But we forget that these were young, hardworking men who loved their country, and they'd signed up to serve Jesus. They wanted to live and die well and do things that matter. And if you're a driven, achieving type of person, you do behave and think like these guys. You do. That I do. If you're a person that is prone to sadness and being down on yourself, it's because you think like these guys. Why do I say that? Because you should be performing better. You sense I should be performing better. So I am capable of both of those ways of being like these guys. And I think a lot of us might be. So we have to think, if I were on this road not knowing what is going to happen, I very likely would have done or thought very similar things. And then you'll notice the other 10 get mad, right? Why? Why are they so mad? Well, because they want to be on the right and the left, right? Why do we get mad when like someone else is angling for a position or something? Well, because I want to be, and maybe I'm going to get there in a different way. I'm not the type to ask, but I'd like to be noticed for what I do, right? Right? It's not that they can't relate, it's that they would go about it differently. And why are they asking now? It seems like a really weird time, like those scenes just juxtapose. So let's say they don't get any of it. Whatever Jesus is saying is just not clicking. Well, they think Jesus is, he's our leader. He's moving into Jerusalem. He's going to take the throne. I want to be on his right or left. Or say they believe him that he's going to die. Who takes the throne if the leader dies? One of the people, one of his right or left hand leaders is the next leader. So what they're thinking at this time is Jesus is going to start a revolution. To be on the right or the left is to be in a royal position of authority and to be next in line. They want to carry that forward. Again, we think like, oh, these guys, they're so, oh man, you know, how could they? They don't appreciate Jesus. No, they want to lead the movement. These are spunky, dedicated, patriotic dudes who are the second in command types who would love to take the wheel and make sure the revolution continues. We love these kind of people. We do. They're the kind that don't just let things fall apart. They stand up and they lead and they take over. They want to keep it alive. And this is important as to why they just did it. Their other fellow disciple, who's a real take charge kind of guy, Peter, is currently in the doghouse. He, in our last text last week, he just got rebuked by Jesus for his response after Jesus turned away a rich man. So Jesus turned away, or he told the rich man, you have to sell everything, and the guy went away sad or angry, we learned. And Peter piped in a similarly odd moment, and he goes, we've left everything to follow after you. And Jesus cuts him off mid-sentence and tells him the first will be last and the last will be first. And he probably went away kind of scratching his head. And he's like, so what about all the, I did leave everything. My wife's literally at the house wondering where I am right now. And he's like, I did what that guy didn't do. So Peter's in the doghouse and James and John are looking at the situation. They're like, well, there was the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus picked three of us to go show us the glorious thing. And it was James, John, Peter. Peter's in the doghouse. Who's left? We are. It just makes sense. These are not crazy, weird guys. These are guys who want to take charge, and they think the third popular guy is in the doghouse, and they're just like, we're ready. We're ready to lead. That's where they are. They're the logical co-captains. And Jesus baits them a little bit, so what do you want me to do for you? And they shoot their shot, you know, one on the right, one on the left. And by the way, we read earlier, their mom had asked for this in the past. They've aspired to this for a long time. They were that kind of kid. Like, I'm a baseball fan, you all know, you've heard it a million times. But there's some kid coming out of Cuba that's like the next big thing, and the scout said, he's that kind of kid. He's a hard worker, you know? He's dedicated, even at age 16. And so all the scouts are like, yeah, that's the kind of kid. That's them. They've been this way. They've been aspiring for this. They've got what it takes. Okay. So I'm trying to say, believe me, if this is your son, you like him. And if this guy's in your organization, you enjoy him. If he's in your church, you're pumped. This is the kind of person you like. And Jesus asked, can you drink the cup I will drink or be baptized with my baptism? And what does he mean? Is he talking about the Lord's Supper and baptism? He's not. He actually is not. They haven't experienced the Lord's Supper yet. And so what he means, in their day, if you were to partake of the cup, it's a shared cup. So unlike us, we have pantries and we've got, you know, cabinets full of cups. Like, go back in there, so many cups. They did not, right? You would have a few cups, maybe only one. So when you partake of a cup, it's a shared experience. It's something that you pass around and you share. So to say partake of the cup means, are you going to share in this experience with me? And they understood that, that they would speak of the cup of suffering in Jesus's day, which would mean if one person's suffering, but it's a community experience, that would be we share in the cup of suffering. Or if you were to go to a wedding, a celebration, you would share in the cup of celebration. So it was about a shared experience. So Jesus is saying, are you with me? Can you join me in what I am about to experience? And they probably assumed it was a suffering, maybe that led to a victory. And baptism actually is a pretty common word back then that didn't simply mean religious baptism. It meant just to be immersed in something. So can you be immersed in this with me? Was what he was saying. There are a lot of examples in ancient texts of just a baptism into a similar experience. It would be used a little metaphorically like that. So they might have thought of an overwhelming battle that was coming up. Will you immerse yourself in that with me? They may have thought that it was facing the possibility of death together. Will you be immersed in that with me? In a sense, kind of like saying, are you counting the cost? Will you really do this? And they said, yeah. And I believe they meant that. We will. We will enter into this with you, whatever the cost, whatever it takes. And then Jesus said to, basically, you don't understand, but yes, you will enter into this with me. As Jesus is going to be rejected and tried and all these, they will experience that with him. They will suffer. They will. It is. Even though they don't get it, Jesus says, yes, it is. So, do you want your Christian life to matter? That's a question for you, right? Do you want to be seen for what you've done as a believer? Do you want to serve? Are you ready and willing to help out? Do you sometimes struggle with others, right? The way they go about being seen or noticed, which is different from the way you would prefer to go about it. You know, some people are just like, hey, did you see the cool thing I did? And inwardly you're like, that's not how you do it. You're supposed to be a soldier. And then they're just supposed to notice you, you know? Do you struggle with those kind of things? Do you even get mad sometimes at other believers in the moment because we are just so different from each other in the ways we go about following Jesus? I think we do. And I think we're supposed to read this play, this theater, and realize this is us. This is us. So then the comparison. So Jesus called them to him and said to them, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. So this is, to me, this is the part where when I was preparing, I thought and I tend to think this, where are we at with a text like this? Where am I? Where might some of you be? And what do we need to think through? And this was the part that kind of hung me up because I thought, I don't know how this really works out. And interestingly, I've been listening to Justin Brierley's podcast, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. I highly recommend it. It's kind of about new atheists that are moving back toward hope and faith and transcendence. And his most recent episode was one where he kind of acknowledged that even though he's telling all these stories of people reopening themselves to God, that there still are a lot of like church abuses and issues in the church that are not helping with the process. He kind of did the podcast where he said, look, we know this is true, right? And there were stories about Mark Driscoll and Ravi Zacharias and others that he said kind of acknowledged, this is also making it hard. And it was good. It was a good episode. I almost skipped it, though, because I'll tell you what, I was like, I don't want to hear these stories. I've heard them. I've heard a lot of them, and I just want to move on to the other atheists with transformed lives. But I was like, no, I think I need to not skip it. Because we have to face that when Jesus said this, number one, it didn't necessarily fix things. Not even in his disciples in this moment. Because they're going to go on. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter's going to bring out the sword and chop off the ear, right? They haven't gotten it. And just because, you know, we identify as his disciples now doesn't mean that we get this, even in this era, as our stories exhibit, as the stories in those podcasts exhibit. This is a continual wrestling match. This is where I'll acknowledge where we are at as a church just for a moment. So we're in the midst of some leadership change. And as we await our members' meeting, we wonder things like why and how. And while we wait and sit in the tension, I want us to remember that Mark's biography, even as it moves us into the drama, invites us to imagine being disciples of Jesus. And he's providing us with a story to remember we must interpret our own journeys through the cross to glory. And this section reminds us that we could be, honestly, in the very presence of Jesus, with him, walking to Jerusalem after 3 years with him, hearing him speak directly to us, seeing his signs and his wonders and his miracles, hearing his incredible teaching directly to us, face to face. We could be one of the 12 that he took aside and explained more deeply, that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And we could hear it from his very mouth, and he could put his hand on our shoulder and explain it to us, and we could still struggle with it. Still. We have to know that. And in light of our own journey, this text is particularly challenging because I thought, shoot, if I were to read this at first blush, it feels like, don't take charge over things. And that's complicated too. But then Paul tells Timothy things like, if you aspire to be an elder, you desire a noble task. And he goes on to list the characteristics of a noble elder. And I thought to myself, like, is this one of those things where Jesus said, the greatest among you will serve, and Paul is just didn't listen to Jesus? Paul goes on to say, elders, they must be above reproach, husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. And Jesus says, the first shall be last. And I see some first shall be last in that, but also, like, these are like qualifications of an all-star. Paul says, you should aspire to be an elder. And who gets to be one? Whoever's really good at it. Wait, which one is it? And we see Paul and Peter in Acts having a profound disagreement in front of a lot of people about what it means to be welcome into the church. And Paul prevails over Peter using scripture and proves this is not an ethnocentric religion, and non-Jewish people should not be burdened with the religious requirements that the Jewish law makes, you know, clear to Jewish people. And Peter concedes, and this is in front of a bunch of people, and it feels like exerting authority, right? I mean, how else could you read it? Did Peter feel served? You know? Was he like, Paul, you've washed my feet, essentially, in front of everyone? I don't know. And then one that reminds us a little bit of our church is Paul and Barnabas, Acts 15. Paul said to Barnabas, hey, let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. This is the most benign, like, good idea ever, right? Like, let's go visit people and encourage them. And I tell you what, they both agreed that that was a good idea. And Barnabas wanted to take with them John, called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who'd withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement. They were separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. So here we have two leaders served together for years, faithful Christians. They want to do the same thing, but they want to do it differently. And there's conflict that, at least in this moment, doesn't resolve the way you'd hope. And there probably wasn't a strong moral right or wrong way here. Apparently, John Mark had been a pain to deal with, and Paul didn't want to deal with that. And Barnabas, who was known as the son of encouragement, that's his name, was like, I'll be patient with the guy. There it is. Was one right, one wrong? No. Different. And it's sad. I'll bet everybody didn't like that outcome. But it's not the end of the story. Later we get hints that they all reunite. Guess who's probably the author of the book of Mark? That guy. We're probably reading his book. We're not 100% sure. Yes. Thank you. I like it. I like that affirmation. So they couldn't work together. Not at that time. Not on that project. But they both continue as Jesus' disciples. Paul, because Mark's an early gospel, probably carried Mark's book around and shared it with churches. And later we know he reconnected with Barnabas. So that's not our exact story, but, and I don't say it to band-aid the sadness of change, but I bring all this up just to say, this stuff's on our minds. And what do we make of Jesus' teaching in a moment where we hear him saying, don't lord it over each other, but serve, when it feels like some people are leading and having to make decisions and is it serving? We have stories of leadership clashes, and Paul teaches Timothy to exhort and rebuke with all authority. Is that serving? Peter teaches young men to be subject to the elders, and the elders to exercise authority like shepherds over sheep. The book of Hebrews says to the people of the church, obey your leaders and submit to them. That sounds like top down, right? For they're keeping watch over your souls as those who will have to give an account. Let them do this with joy, not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. Which, by the way, I especially want to apply this little thing to our church right now and say, Mike, Ray, and Andrew at this time need you to take this to heart. You've received communication from them about our journey. After hours and hours of deliberation and prayer, sleepless nights, they know the weight of it. So listen to them. Read their communications closely. Follow their instructions. John and I have committed to that. That's part of holding the office. Our path was in their hands. Relieve their groaning because they're tired. Seek their joy. So still, though, there's a tension. Obey, submit, correct, rebuke. And Jesus says, don't lord it over them. So what do we do with that? Does Paul follow Jesus? Does Peter follow Jesus? Or are they just doing what the unbelievers do, lording it over them? What do we do with the tension? So I want to work that out just a little bit as we think about this Christian way. Jesus goes on to say, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom for many. A few things emerge from this teaching of Jesus. The Christian is called to serve. Serving does not mean not leading. And our pattern is Jesus. I want to approach him in reverse. Remember the scene that we're in. Who's the leader? Who's leading them to Jerusalem? Jesus is. Jesus is, yeah. He's walking ahead. Everyone is following him. He's teaching. He's taking them aside. He's clarifying. He's leading. He's the one saying, not so among you, but he is leading them. And his leading is characterized by serving, because it's not self-serving leading, it's serving them. He's explaining things to them. He's preparing them. He's teaching them what it is going to be like to follow him. It's not about getting a position for himself. It's not about his own pleasure. It's about preparing them for what they need. We've seen that even in last week's text, that serving doesn't guarantee that another person enjoys the experience. I believe that Jesus served the rich young man by inviting him to walk away from everything he had. And he walked away upset at that time. We don't know his whole story. But sometimes when Jesus is doing something for you, it doesn't feel so good. I think the disciples are feeling that way right here. John and James are like, I want to be at your right and left, and he's not giving it to them. And again, they probably feel like corrected more than served. But Jesus is leading them in a good way. Leadership is complicated. His serving is meant to be aimed at actually what is good for you, what will help you. Everyone who's been in leadership knows that's really tough to figure out. Leading is characterized by serving. Ultimately, Jesus' life will be given. His life is not only lived for his safety, his comfort, or his promotion, but the good of others. In fact, he's going to be a ransom, which means that for unworthy people who can't pay him back, he will pay everything. And that is servanthood. Now, who could ever live up to this? I would not dare to claim that I do. I can't. This is an impossible level of leadership that Jesus exhibits. So he is our pattern, but he's more. In the Christian faith, people, all of us, are called to Jesus' mission, but not to lead ourselves, but to lead under him. We're called to emulate Jesus, but also to receive the leadership of Jesus. And that's the only way forward in the midst of an imperfect world. We must seek to emulate Jesus and follow him, but ultimately we have to acknowledge that it's he who we're trusting in. That in any imperfect times when we fail and people fail us, we have to remember he is not failing us and we are complete in him. It was a joy to be at Rob and Alexi's wedding last weekend. Yes. If you didn't know, they just got married and they're back. Yeah. Take that opportunity for a drink of water. I should have clapped longer. If you've ever sat with me in premarital, as they just had to do for a long time, we discuss these things, right? We're called into these deep vows of covenantal love. We're called to minister to one another, but we quickly find out that if our ministry is dependent on the other person deserving it and doing it for us perfectly, it's going to end up blowing up. You're going to end up getting frustrated and looking at the other person going, yeah, here's what happens. You say to them, well, you're supposed to do this for me and you're not doing it. So I might withhold what I would do. That dynamic happens all the time, right? So what do you do about it? Well, the way that you can move forward most effectively is to know that ultimately you are looked after, served, and cared for by God. And so even when another person fails you and you're called to minister to them, you can draw from that bank account, from what God has done for you, and continue forward moving toward an unworthy person. And by the way, when you move toward an unworthy person, it is a powerful tool to unlock what God is doing in their lives. Our refusal to serve one another tends to push us apart. When we draw from that resource and move toward each other, it's a powerful tool for healing. So we have to keep Jesus as our leader in mind, okay? Then all believers are called to serve. All believers under Jesus are called to serve. And there, while there is leadership in the church, they're all called to serve. So elders, yeah, they're called to serve. Deacons, called to serve. It doesn't mean there's like a flat organization with no leading, but it means that every leader is called to serve and every person within the community is called to serve. And in fact, the more responsibility you're given, you're actually encouraged to teach others to serve and to build that into the whole life of the community. In the book of Acts, the deacons are set up to oversee the distribution to the widows. And I've always thought it was interesting, the high level of qualification that they were supposed to have. And then Stephen gives this speech, like this historical speech explaining Jesus from the Old Testament, that every time I read it, I go like, this guy's legit. Like, this is insane. This is so thoughtful and deep and good. And you go, he had to have that to deliver food? He had to do that to really? Did nobody do anything in the church? Because if you couldn't do that, you can't even like deliver food. I mean, how dare you hand out bulletins out at the front if you can't give a speech like Stephen? Just kidding. But isn't that how it would seem? No, here's the deal. The deacons were servants who I believe were the ones who led the church into serving. They needed to be mature because they were going to discern. There, you read in Paul about what type of widow they're going to support and how exactly to parse that out. It takes a lot of wisdom. It takes a lot of wisdom and discernment. And I believe these deacons, they weren't just like the only ones who could serve food. They were going to discern how the church was going to serve and lead the community into service with wisdom. So the principle here applies to everyone. And so you don't have to be that mature to hand out bulletins. You just have to be willing to be called to serve. Because we have a servant king, and we're all following behind a servant king. So that's why our mission, as you see painted in the little entryway there, broken people, that's all of us. We all need Jesus. Given grace, that's what Jesus offers to us. That's why he became a ransom for us, because no, we do not live up to what we're supposed to live up to. And then serving others, because that is how we are called to follow after Jesus, who is a serving king. And that's supposed to be soaking into us all, even though I guarantee you, like the disciples, we don't get it all the time. Fortunately, our hope is not in getting it. Our hope is in our servant king, which brings us to the table, where we accept not only identification with him. This is a moment where it does ask, even though he wasn't referring to the Lord's Supper, but to come and receive the service of a serving king is to say that I will drink his cup with him. I will identify with him. The way that Jesus is viewed in the culture, so will we. The way that Jesus is spoken about in our world, so will I. The way that Jesus is treated by believers who forget that he exists, 95% of the day, we will experience that as well. Can we drink the cup and identify with Jesus? His baptism, will we be immersed in what he was immersed in? So he does lay down his life. He is the ultimate, thanks to him, right? That we don't have to die for each other in order to save one another. But we are called to lay our lives down in service to one another, even when it's really, really difficult. And so this table is an invitation to be immersed in what he was immersed in, to be identified with him, to share in him, but also his pattern. Because as we walk to the table and receive him as our king, we walk away from the table sent on his mission to carry forward that pattern into our world, into our community. So on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he broke bread. This day is coming soon in our text in Mark, by the way. You have to remember, we're on the precipice of this moment in the book. He broke bread and he said, "This is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of it, remember me. Remember who I am. Remember how I did things. Remember what it means to follow after me. Remember me." And then he took the cup from the table. Remember, there's one cup. We've tweaked that just a little bit because it's, we can't all have wine, so there's that. But there's one cup, one Christ that we share in. This speaks to our unity across denominations, across the world, across time with other believers. This speaks to the capacity that he has to cover over all of our sins. This speaks to the suffering that he endured to cover our sins. And this speaks to the celebration we anticipate in his kingdom when all things are made new. So we're going to do our three weekly acts of worship that the Christian church has always done. We are going to take the Lord's Supper together. You'll notice that after Kendra leads us in songs, people will line up right here in this aisle to come forward and receive the body and the blood of Christ. And in this, we remember what he's done, who he is, and what we are called to do. The barrier to entry is that you trust in Jesus. It's you don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to have it perfect. But if you're able to say, even just an eking sense of, "But I want to trust him," then you can, and you should. Then we will sing together. Kendra's going to lead us in songs, and these songs are meant to sink these things deep in our hearts, but even to open our hearts to an understanding that only a song can bring, to help us sense and feel the love of Jesus. We're going to give. We always have giving as kind of in the back there. Some people tie it in with this time. Some people have it on repeat. But we hope that however you do this, that you're viewing it as an act of serving in light of a servant king. So Jesus gives to us, gives all things to us. Every dollar that we have is a gift from him. And so the idea is to then follow him with our giving, as we do with the rest of our lives. And then we're going to take a time of silence as we prepare for the Lord's Supper. So that time is meant for confession of several things. You can confess faith in Jesus. You can tell him, I hear you. I want to receive you. I believe you. Confession can be a confession of doubt or fear or concern. You can open up to him because he is ready and willing to hear you, and in fact is the safest place to come with your doubts, your fears, or your frustrations. It's also a time where you can confess ways that you have struggled to follow after him. So as we talk today about all the ways these disciples didn't get it and the ways that we do not get it, if you've identified one of those today, you can just bring it to him. And in bringing that to Jesus, you will find that he is full of mercy. So Jesus doesn't look at his disciples and say, "What were you thinking?" just to, make them feel bad. He teaches them because he's merciful and he's calling them back, and he's patient, and he is going to be the same to you. So I'm going to pray for 2 minutes, I'm going to pray and then leave 2 minutes. I don't know how long I'll pray, but there will be 2 minutes of silence for you to spend in prayer. Father, we praise you for this hope, for being a servant God, for sending your son into the world to exhibit your heart, your ways, and your compassion toward us. We thank you for the book of Mark, where we get to feel and experience what it was like for you to walk among us. And I pray that we would have a deeper sense of that as we continue to listen to you and read your word and sing and follow after you. So Give us boldness to come into your throne room of grace and speak with you now and lead us as we pray.